This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jonathan Lethem, won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his novel Motherless Brooklyn. Now Lethem has a new novel called The Fortress of Solitude that's based on his own experiences growing up in Brooklyn. The novel revolves around two best friends, Dylan Ebdis and Mingus Rood, who live in a largely African-American neighborhood in Brooklyn. When the novel begins in the 70s, Dylan is one of the few white students in his grade school. His mother is a hippie. His father is a painter. Mingus is the son of a soul singer who used to be in a popular vocal group. The novel begins in the 70s, ends in the 90s, and follows the neighborhood through the changes of hip-hop, crack, and gentrification, and follows the two main characters' diverging paths as Dylan goes to a predominantly white college in Vermont and Mingus goes to prison. Reviewing the novel in the New York Times Sunday Book Review, A.O. Scott described it as melancholy and marvelous. Your new book really confronts the issue of race and what it's like to grow up as a white child in a largely African-American neighborhood. Race is a very difficult subject to write about. Was it hard for you to take it on?
Well, I avoided it for years. I wrote a whole series of novels that dealt with questions of difference and alienation very indirectly. So, of course, it was intimidating. And then in the doing, I was constantly afraid that I'd wander into pontificating or sociology or trying to do something I'm not good at. And I just kept reminding myself that I wanted to make it very much an intimate report, a kind of a testimony from one body's experience moving through time, but not try to speak for anyone.
Now, this is a semi-autobiographical novel, and you're writing from the point of view of a white kid who's growing up in an African-American neighborhood that calls into question what it means to be a majority group or a minority group, because the white kid is, after all, the member of the majority group, the theoretically more powerful group, but in his neighborhood, he's the minority group, and he's the kid who's picked on a lot.
Right.
So it's a very kind of confusing territory to be in.
It's sort of a double reverse, and yet all of the, you know, wider context of American society was sort of present, I think, on those streets where I grew up, and I've given Dylan the burden of those experiences. The fact that a white kid had different kind of escape routes, different ways to move out of those streets and those very immediate and confusing racial conflicts that Dylan lives through, that was never out of anyone's mind. The fact that I was sort of free to export myself to college and to an America where the white majority was, of course, the rule, wasn't lost on anyone.
Now, the parents in the novel have chosen to live in this neighborhood because, well, first of all, they don't have much money. And also, it's a kind of badge of their social consciousness. The father is an artist. The mother sees herself as a social activist. What were your parents' motivations for living in the neighborhood you lived in? And you should describe that neighborhood.
Well, I grew up in a neighborhood that's now called Borum Hill. And just before that, it was either a nameless place or it was South Brooklyn or Gowanus. It was kind of a zone between the more upright and already gentrified or middle-class neighborhoods of Brooklyn, like Park Slope and Brooklyn Heights. And the neighborhood was really a patchwork. It wasn't only black by any means. It was black and Hispanic and hippie and sort of other. There were legacies of Native Americans living in the neighborhood because for whatever reason, the Native Americans who built the skyscrapers had settled in Borum Hill. And my parents were attracted to it, I think in a very beautiful and, you know, and hopeful way. They my mother grew up in Queens, and felt like a Brooklyn street kid herself. My father was a painter looking for a home big enough to include a studio, and this was a place where you could buy a townhouse for kind of nothing. And the contradictions of a coming gentrification and the way that would compromise their own political ideals was something that was hard to anticipate.
Now, the mother in your novel boasts that her son is one of only three white children in the whole school, the elementary school. Did your mother have that attitude, too? And are there things you thought she didn't understand about what it meant to be one of the very few white kids in the elementary school?
Well, that's a good question. She was proud that we were in public school when a lot of the other white kids in the neighborhood were being exported to local private schools. But she wasn't nearly as scattershot or flighty as the character Rachel in the book. My mother was pretty savvy about street life and a great guide to the neighborhood. She actually really knew the way things were playing out on the streets and in the schools. She was sick. She died when I was 14, and she was sick for a few years before that. So her kind of savvy and her know-how was unfortunately taken away.
Did you stay in the neighborhood after she died? I think your parents were separated by then.
We lived in the neighborhood, and my father continued to live in the neighborhood until just a few years ago. And I'm actually back there myself. Of course, it's a neighborhood that's become very, very fashionable now. It's one of the nicest parts of New York City to live in, I think.
Is that bizarre for you to experience?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, the simplest thing to say is it's a nice place for me, as it would be for anyone. And if I weren't from Borough Hill, I very well might have ended up living there again, or living there for the first time now, because it's attractive. And I see it with a kind of double vision. I see the old stuff, which is still incompletely renovated. You know, the thing about Brooklyn that I think sets it apart from Manhattan is that it never renovates completely. The past is always sort of lying around in chunks in full view if you want to see it. And as much as it's changed and as much as obviously property values have skyrocketed, there are lots of kids I grew up with living in the houses that their parents owned. There are lots of parts of Smith Street and Court Street that are still deeply, you know, deep ethnic enclaves of Dominicans or Puerto Ricans or Italians. And it doesn't feel to me that it's ever going to change completely.
Kids are always bullying kids. And that's just the way the world works, I guess. But when you were bullied in the neighborhood you were growing up, did race come into play into that bullying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the search for me in trying to write this book was to give name to something, an experience that I'd had and never been able to talk about, because it fell kind of between the names I was offered. You know, when I first left New York, I was asked a question people who grew up in New York, especially in the 70s, are asked constantly, which is, have you ever been mugged? And I wouldn't know what to say. It seems so simple, but I knew what they had in mind was a kind of, you know, Kojak or Batman scenario where a guy with a handkerchief on his face, you know, pulls a gun out and makes two well-dressed New Yorkers step into an alley and, you know, says, your money or your life. And that hadn't happened to me, certainly. But that what had happened to me wasn't only bullying. It wasn't only typical schoolyard stuff. That there was a undercurrent of racial hazing in the kind of experience I'd had that it was systematic, but it was also inconsistent. The experience changed a lot, and it was very slippery and hard to talk about. In fact, its unnameability was almost its primary quality. You were told at the time, this isn't anything. I'm taking your money, but I'm your friend. You know I like you. What do you think, I'm not your friend? Are you a racist? And the kind of undercurrent of, rehearsals of racial identity was everywhere in this experience. I knew I was meant to understand that I was a white boy, and that that entitled me to certain privileges, but it also meant that, you know, I was going to pay a kind of toll of my bus pass or whatever pocket money I had with me pretty much every day I went to school. And that I wasn't going to get to talk about it, because to do so would be to seem to be a racist.
You did give a name to this.
Yeah, yoking. It's a funny story. I took that word for local vernacular. I really thought when the kids in my neighborhood would say, throw a yoke on him, or, you know, you got yoked, that it was something so specific to the 70s and to Brooklyn and to the black and Hispanic kids. And I suppose slang always seems a lot more recent than it really is, but it turns out yoking is kind of, it goes back to like 18th century English slang. It's a synonym for mugging, having to do with specifically kind of an arm thrown around a neck, a headlock. And it was really liberating to me when I discovered that the word had some provenance, that it wasn't just my own sort of personal nightmare.
And why is yoking better than mugging?
Well, yoking was, as I say, this intermediate activity. It wasn't real crime. It wasn't totally hostile. It had a conversational quality. It was, in a weird way, it was a kind of active community making. I was yoked by a lot of guys I knew, and I was often hanging out with them shortly thereafter. Or, you know, I was yoked by the older brothers of kids I was hanging out with. It was a transaction, and I ended up feeling that it was kind of a rehearsal.
Were you able to talk to your mother about this?
Barely. I mean, it took me years to talk even to friends who'd gone through it with me in school. It was something that was a nameable in full view. My brother and my good friends were part of this experience too, and it was something that we were so ashamed of that we'd erase it almost instantly. We'd erase it walking home from school before we got a chance to talk to our parents about it.
There's another white boy who moves into the neighborhood, but your main character doesn't want to deal with him because his character is weak, and he gives off the sense of being oppressed. And your main character describes this kid as practicing preemptive suffering. Nobody could do much with a kid who was already crying. He didn't have a spirit to crush. Was that your observation of other kids when you were growing up?
Actually, that's as much confession as it is an observation. I had a when I started to kind of research this book, which was really in some ways like it was the first scholarship I've ever done in my life. I was a college dropout and I'd never learned to study, but I sort of had to write a dissertation in my own childhood to just, you know, find out what songs were playing on the radio when I was doing this. But I also was going back and digging up old friends. And I thought I remembered a lot about this stuff. And I did remember a lot about this stuff, but there was one blind spot. There was one thing I hadn't really allowed myself to acknowledge, which was my own utter cowardice. I mean, the degree to which I bailed out on other kids who were in threatening situations and saved my own skin, and the degree to which I kind of cringed and keened on the ground, just begging not to be hurt. And I had a couple of friends lead me very patiently and gently to the memory of how I would fall down before I was even hit, and that's an image that is kind of pathetic but also funny. And I gave it to Arthur Lom. He's kind of the guy who figures out that strategy.
So I take it you weren't a real physical kid. You were probably reading.
No, well, I was raised as a Quaker, so I wasn't allowed to hit anyone.
Great.
This was basic principle. I was a pacifist. I was meant to be solving these problems with, nonviolent resistance, and I guess that's what that consisted of.
Did that seem unfair to you that you were supposed to be nonviolent? You were from this nonviolent background, but on the other hand, in a neighborhood where power and dignity and self-respect were probably measured by your ability to physically stand up for yourself.
Well, there was such a variety. I hope the book shows the kind of enormous palette of approaches that kids in this neighborhood took. And I really have gathered so many into these characters, these small number of rather isolated characters. I've gathered the testimony and the memory and the impression of lots and lots of different responses and strategies. I mean, Arthur, the kid who starts as the cringer and the one who pretends to have asthma in order not to get hit, ends up as this ultimate assimilator, a kid who passes as though he's black himself. He's kind of an early version of, you know, the Beastie Boys archetype. And the strategies and the responses change day to day. It's why it was always so difficult to talk about, because it was a kind of transitive experience. Problems were being worked out in this arena, in a way, and no strategy could ever be stable. So falling down, cringing, that was one moment in my experience, but talking your way out of things or making friends with people or turning situations on their ear, You know, I tried to get all of the possible responses into the book, not just the most humiliating ones.
For the main character growing up in this novel, everything seems to have some kind of like racial subtext, and certainly the music does. And there's a great paragraph I want you to read about a record that kind of strikes terror into the heart of your main character,
right.
Dylan. Should we say what the record is before you read it, or?
Well, it sort of emerges, so
yeah.
Either way.
No, let's let it emerge.
Okay. It was entirely possible that one song could destroy your life. Yes, musical doom could fall on a lone human form and crush it like a bug. The song, that song, was sent from somewhere else to find you, to pick the scab of your whole existence. The song was your personal crappy fate, manifest as a throb of pop floating out of radios everywhere. At the very least, the song was the soundtrack to your destruction, the theme. Your days reduced to a montage cut to its cowbell beat, inexorable double bass line and raunch vocal, a sort of chanted sneer surrounded by groans of pleasure. The stutter and blurt of what, a tuba? French horn? Rhythm guitar and trumpet pitched to mockery. The singer might as well have held a gun to your head. How could it have been allowed to happen? How could it have been allowed on the radio? That song ought to be illegal. It wasn't racist. You'll never sort that one out. Don't even start. So much as anti-you. Yes, they were dancing and singing and moving to the groovin', and just when it hit me, somebody turned around and shouted. Every time your sneakers met the street, the end of that summer, somebody was hurling it at your head. That song. Forget what happens when you start haunting the green-tiled halls of Intermediate School 293. September 7th, 1976, the week Dylan Ebdus began 7th grade in the main building on Court Street in Butler, Wild Cherry's Play That Funky Music was the top song on the rhythm and blues charts. 14 days later, it topped Billboard's pop charts. Your Misery's Anthem, number one song in the nation. Sing it through gritted teeth. White boy. Lay down the boogie and play that funky music till you die.
And for anyone who doesn't know the record, it's, you know, it's Play That Funky Music, White Boy.
Well, I later found out my copy editor discovered that White Boy isn't in the title. It stops at Play That Funky Music. So.
But it's in the song.
It's in the song.
So, now, later on, your character becomes a music critic. And it's
right.
It's only later on in life that he realizes that the band that did Play That Funky Music, White Boy, was actually a white band.
Those are white guys who inflicted that on him, yeah.
So what's the difference to him, whether it's a black group or white group? How does the meaning change in his mind?
Well, Dylan, this character, he reads race and culture and music so intensely to try to discover what's wrong with the way he feels about himself. And he's tormented by these ironies, these kinds of double reverses. You know, I come from a family of right-thinking leftists, and yet I'm constantly accused of racism just for being beaten up in school. He's tormented by the ironies of his own freedom to escape the situation by hanging out with other white kids and leaving the neighborhood, including his dear black friends, behind. And he's completely tormented by the musical ironies, that the things he loves the most, the things that seem to tell him how he feels about himself, don't match his apparent, cultural portfolio. And then, of course, the fact that this song that he kind of adores and loathes for pinning him to his place in time and culture, for being he's like the white boy in the crosshairs of this song. The fact that it was a bunch of spaced out Midwestern, a bar band basically that created this black sounding hit. It drives him out, absolutely crazy. These guys know nothing of black experience, as far as he can tell.
Did this record mean anything to you when you were growing up?
Well, sure. I mean, it was sort of the bane of my existence, but it's kind of irresistible. You could only laugh at yourself for having it trapped in your head because it was being sort of turned against you. But it was the thing that exposed you. It made you naked that this song was on the radio at this time in your life, and that the phrase "white boy," which was already beginning to dog your steps, was suddenly okay. It was in the cultural vocabulary. It was the number one song on the radio.
You know, as you've pointed out, the people in your life kind of related to their world through culture, whether it was, you know, graffiti or music or you know, a painting. And your father is a painter. Dylan's father in the novel is a painter as well. But the father in the novel is also, instead of painting on canvases, he's doing this experimental painting on film, so his images can have motion. And the father takes the son to a talk by Stan Brakhage, the famous experimental filmmaker. And Brakhage is saying things like, "I would rather see my work as an attempt to clear aesthetic areas, to free film from previous arts and ideologies, perhaps to leave it clear to be of use to men and women of various kinds, which might help evolve human sensibility." I'm wondering if your father had that kind of more abstracted, intellectualized approach to art, and what that meant to you. If you know, because Dylan in the novel is kind of fascinated by this, and he's hanging on every word, but it doesn't understand a word of it.
Yeah. Actually, my father's own painting is much more messy and engaged than anything I've given to this father character in the book. Abraham's film is a kind of super purified and he's a very hermetic artist, and his practice is very isolated and monk-like. It's actually, in some ways, Abraham's a confession of my own work as a writer. That painted film and this incremental progress day by day is really a description of a writer working on a long novel. It's a self-portrait. My father's painting was, and his life as an artist, was much more ground level. He was really engaged with the neighborhood, and his work is very colorful and full of content and full of politics. And his studio was always full of live models, many of them just people from the neighborhood. And he was very engaged. So Abraham's hermetic style is a kind of an exaggeration of, you know, the response to living in a confusing place that I flirted with, which was to just pretend you didn't know anything about it.
Right. In writing about race in your new novel, were you afraid at any point that you would be misunderstood? Because it's such a loaded subject, and people are always reading between the lines to see what is your motivation? What are you really saying? So were you afraid that you'd be misunderstood and that
of
you
course.
Might come off as sounding racist in spite of the fact that that's certainly not your intention?
Well, of course. And I mean, I had to embrace that fear. You know, I wasn't trying to write a very short, simple book that could be purified of ambivalence or confusion. There's a lot of stuff in it that probably kind of is racist in its way, back and forth. You know, there are characters who are racist, and it's an embrace of my own experience, and I wanted to keep it kind of scrupulously intimate, and as I said at the start, make it like a testimony of one person, one body in time, not preach or pontificate or pretend to have figured things out that our culture hasn't figured out. But the fear was with me all the way through, of course.
When you were growing up, you know, your mother was a social activist, your father a painter. You've also described your mother as a hippie. And, you know, people who are in the arts or people who were hippies, bohemians, often see themselves as being like outside of class. It's like the bohemian class is sometimes outside of, you know, working class, middle class, upper class. At least that's how it's sometimes perceived by the larger culture, and that's how they sometimes perceive themselves. As a child of that type of family, did you feel outside of social class, or did you feel a part of it, and where did you think you fit?
Well, I had a kind of beautiful, a blissful confusion about class that came from the vitality of my parents' bohemian milieu. Their world was so full of life and art and energy that I never thought to wonder whether we were deprived of something. It didn't make any sense to think of myself as being from a poor family, despite, you know, what in retrospect might have been kind of whopping clues, like the fact that I did go to public school instead of private school. And it was more possible to sustain that blissful confusion that surrounded my family. I didn't understand that there was real privilege. I did understand that the kids living in the projects down the street, you know, had less than we did. So if anything, I thought we were probably rich. But I didn't think about it very coherently.
Now, you went to public school, and your parents are very proud of that fact, that you were in public school. What kind of education do you think you got in the public school in your neighborhood?
Well, you know, the experience changed again and again. I was pulled out of my grade school, my local grade school, the one that I leave Dylan in. I actually left behind to go to kind of cross neighborhoods into a Carroll Gardens, which was a mostly Italian neighborhood. So suddenly, I was among a lot of other white kids who nonetheless saw me as another kind of outsider or freak. But strictly speaking, the education there was magnificent. I had the best teacher of my life in fourth grade, a woman named Carmen Farina, who I dedicated my first novel to. And she was as in love with books and talking and culture and life as my parents were. And so suddenly school was very, very alive for me. And that happened again when I got to high school. I went to Music and Art, which is this great public school. And, you know, it's a kind of legendary public school in New York with a legacy of, you know, all sorts of funny, famous people who went there. And I was part of this great tradition there. Again, one that was sort of classless and very utopian. So I was lucky. And New York City has vestiges of, you know, the greatest public education system ever constructed, I suspect. And I was in and out of really exciting schools, actually.
Jonathan Lethem, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Lethem's new novel is called The Fortress of Solitude.